partner countries to provide UNRWA with all necessary funding and alleviate the suffering of millions of Palestinian refugees. We also maintain that the framework agreement will place UNRWA under the U.S. hegemony and undermine the Palestinian refugees' right of return to the land of their ancestors.
The UN agency provides education, health, and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in Al-Quds, the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. During a press conference, Palestinian factions slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of Palestinian refugees.
Settler colonialist regimes that helped Zionist gangs occupy Palestine and displace its people in 1948 must stop helping the Israeli regime. Upon the creation of the illegitimate Zionist entity, those gangs destroyed over 500 Palestinian towns and villages and committed dozens of massacres against the indigenous Palestinian population.
UNRWA has long been a priority target for the Israeli regime and its allies. Over the past decades, the Israeli regime had been campaigning to defund UNRWA and end its mandate.
The so-called framework agreements between the United States and UNRWA aims to cancel the rights of Palestinian refugees. Palestinians across the political spectrum denounced the agreements. The U.S. wants to turn the UNRWA into a security agency in the occupied territories.
Experts say the so-called framework agreement with UNRWA is an attempt by the United States to delegitimize and depoliticize the issue of Palestinian refugees. UNRWA is the UN agency responsible for the welfare of millions of Palestinian refugees in West Asia who were displaced and dispossessed upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Since February, there has been calm at the line of control, a de facto border that divides Kashmir between India and Pakistan. But despite relative peace at the border, the situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir is precarious. There have been daily reports of human rights abuses.
The people of the occupied territory continue to suffer under India's brutal military siege. Extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrests and detention of Kashmiri youth, harassment and custodial torture continue with impunity while fundamental freedoms are suspended and Hurriyat leadership remains incarcerated.
Against this backdrop, a special envoy of the 57-member Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or OIC, is visiting Pakistan. His visit is aimed at getting the first-hand account of the ground situation of the disputed territory. The special envoy met Prime Minister Imran Khan, who briefed him about the current situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir. But the public opinion is divided over the role of OIC on Kashmir.
I feel OIC has played no significant role in the resolution of the Kashmir dispute. The OIC has not pursued the issue at the international level.
Major problem in Pakistan.
Kashmir is a major problem between the two countries. Except for passing a few resolutions, the OIC has not done enough for the Kashmir cause. It should play a more proactive role.
In an official statement, the OIC special envoy expressed Islamic world's abiding solidarity and support to the legitimate Kashmiri struggle for their right to self-determination as enshrined in the relevant UN Security Council resolutions. Kashmir is at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan for over seven decades. Both countries claim the region in full, but rule only parts of it. While Pakistan has granted access to the OIC special envoy to its part of Kashmir, India has barred international delegations from visiting its part of Kashmir. This, Pakistan says, highlights Indian effort to hide human rights abuses in the disputed region. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Islamic Jihad movement held a massive festival in the Gaza Strip marking the second anniversary of the assassination of Baha Abu'l-Ata, Islamic Jihad commander, who was killed by Israeli airstrikes on his house. Targeting Abu'l-Ata triggered a tough round of violence between Palestinians and the Israeli regime.
We are here to express our support to the resistance front that has never failed to defend us.
Palestinians in Gaza are living in a continuous struggle, but this makes us more determined to defend our rights.
Baha Abul Ata was the head of Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of Islamic Jihad. Baha was one of the most prominent members of its military wing and played a major role in carrying out operations against Israel.
We will remain steadfast and committed to our oath to our leader, Baha Abul Ata. Losing our commanders won't undermine our resistance. We will resist and won't be hesitant to defend our people and the Palestinian cause.
Palestinians in this event also stressed following in the footsteps of Abul Ata in the battle against the Israeli occupation, vowing to keep their resistance until their rights are restored.
Our message to the Israeli regime is that if you assassinate a leader, there will be thousands of other leaders to continue the path of resistance. The killing of Palestinian leaders won't undermine our will to keep up our fight against Israel.
Palestinians here say that the killing of the leaders won't stop the battle against the Zionists. They also vow to remain committed to their resistance as their only means to defend their rights. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
New Delhi hosted a third regional summit to discuss the ongoing situation in neighboring Afghanistan following the recent pullout of U.S. and NATO forces from the country. The conference was chaired by India's National Security Advisor Ajit Doval and his counterparts from other Central Asian nations. India's National Security Advisor opened the dialogue.
We all have been keenly watching the developments in that country. These have important implications not only for the people of Afghanistan but also for its neighbors and the region. This is the time for close consultations amongst us, greater cooperation and interaction, and coordination among the regional countries.
Top security officials reiterated pledge to work for ensuring safe Afghanistan and what they called free of safe haven for global terrorism. The delegates also called for formation of inclusive government in Kabul, stressing the territory should not be used for sheltering, training, planning or financing terror activities.
This could perhaps be the first time Central Asian countries are coming together on a single platform to not only discuss their role in rebuilding war-ravaged Afghanistan, but also formulate a collective strategies which could promote peace, stability and security in the region.
Issues related to radicalization, extremism, separatism and drug trafficking in the region were also discussed in the meeting. The officials expressed deep concern about the sufferings Afghan people have endured before and after the U.S. fallout. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, stressed on rebuilding inclusive Afghanistan, saying U.S. policies brought nothing but miseries and devastation in the region.
Afghanistan's neighbors need to fulfill its duties to settle the crisis unfolding in the country, including efforts to hold to account the countries behind the current situation there, establish an inclusive government comprised of all ethnicities there, and tackle the humanitarian crisis gripping the war-torn country. The Islamic Republic of Iran is ready to rebuild Afghanistan. Regional partners should also exert pressure on the United States to unblock the financial resources of the oppressed nation.
Security chiefs from Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Russia, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan also attended the talks. However, neighboring China and Pakistan did not attend the forum, citing scheduling reasons. The first two editions of the event were held in Iran in September 2018 and December 2019. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Leaving amid shouts of shame, Israel's UK ambassador, Zippy Hotovly, escorted flower in hand by her security detail to her car as British police ward off peaceful pro-Palestine protesters earlier this week. Hotovly, a fervent opponent of Palestinian statehood, had been controversially invited by the London School of Economics Student Union to a debate on Middle East peace.
As she emerged from the debate, she was met with students and pro-Palestine activists exercising their democratic right to protest. But there was a problem with that. It was a peaceful protest against the ambassador of one of Britain's closest allies with powerful pressure groups in British politics.
That has meant a torrent of criticism and condemnation from the pro-Israel media and government ministers. From the British Foreign Secretary, who has called the protest unacceptable, to the Home Secretary, who has described it as disgusting and anti-Semitic.
What is the evidence for this? People were opposing the Israeli policy at one, and secondly, this particular ambassador who actually says there is no such a thing as Palestinians. Every inch of the land belongs to the Israelis. So by that definition means that this is encouragement to ethnic cleansing.
Once again, an expression of solidarity for Palestinians portrayed as anti-Semitism. One of the targets of that labeling, the chair of the Islamic Human Rights Commission himself, who spent a lifetime calling out the Israeli regime's repressive apartheid against Palestinians.
What do? They actually try to be sort of racist towards others, use the only tool that they could possibly use of saying anti-Semitic, and then sort of trying mud at everybody else who's trying to stand up for justice and say, this is standard, this type of person should not be given a voice. If you look at genocide and ethnic cleansing, it always starts by denying people of their right to live where they are living.
It's a curious thing about freedom of speech and of expression in the UK. While it's free against some, it's restricted against others. Saeed Purza, London.
Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Political Affairs and the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bakhari Khani, visited London for high-level talks ahead of upcoming negotiations in the Austrian capital that have stalled since June of 2021. It was the first official visit of a high-ranking Iranian diplomat to the UK Foreign Office in some time.
I met with a number of UK Foreign Ministry officials today. We had comprehensive discussions on bilateral relations, regional issues, and also future negotiations.
The long and complicated history between Tehran and London means there are always matters up for discussion. But topping the agenda this time around are the sanctions removal talks due at the end of the month. The Islamic Republic has underlined its position as not simply a return to the negotiating table, rehashing previously decided matters.
The main purpose of these talks from the Islamic Republic of Iran's standpoint is to lift the illegal sanctions imposed on the Iranian nation by the U.S. government in blatant violation of the JCPOA and the blatant violation of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231.
Having been in Europe for the better part of a week, relaying the Iranian perspective was paramount.
I've had good conversations with the political officials of France, Germany, and the UK in the past 3 days. At the same time as being straightforward and serious, those conversations were clear and progressive. I shared our perspective on the necessary framework for the upcoming talks in an unequivocal and very transparent manner.
Iran has already stated its willingness to deliver a good agreement, but that might hinge on the willingness of the remaining parties to honor the existing terms and walk back the failed maximum pressure campaign initiated by Washington after their unilateral withdrawal back in 2018. More will be clear when all the parties meet on November the 29th. Amina Taylor, London.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
this supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, unless Thou repelst him. By means of name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. A New York Times report reveals how the U.S. military bombed civilians in Syria and then bulldozed the site to try to cover up the news. A 500-pound bomb was dropped on mostly women and children. Then it was followed by two more bombs, taking care of any survivors. At the end, at least 80 people were killed. The U.S. says 16 of them were fighters and four were civilians, and they did not bother to even try to describe who the others were. However, they had decided to sit on the news of this act to try to avoid being accused of committing a war crime. Stay with us as we take a look at this event on this Spotlight.
It's March 18th, 2019. An American F-15 drops a 500-pound bomb on a crowd of women and children in an area near the town of Baghouz in Syria's Deir ez-Zor province. Minutes later, another warplane drops an even bigger bomb, then another, killing the few survivors of the first strike. The initial death toll was put at 70. Fast forward to November 2021. The U.S. Central Command has acknowledged that 80 people were killed in the strikes. While claiming that 16 of the victims were Daesh terrorists, it admits that it's unclear if the rest were civilians. CENTCOM has also defended the attacks as justified and conducted in self-defense, arguing that the targeted women and children could have been combatants. But investigations carried out by the New York Times provide a different account of the incident. According to the Times, a U.S. Air Force lawyer who oversaw the operation believed he had witnessed possible war crimes and notified the authorities. The Pentagon later carried out an independent inquiry into the incident, but the Times says the subsequent report was, quote, stripped of any mention of the bombing. The newspaper also says the reports were delayed and classified, and the attack site was bulldozed shortly after.
So this is one piece that is coming out, very important, because it shows just how criminal the war is and the cover-up that takes place at every level, even when within the army, those who saw it and have access tried to bring it to light and instead were dismissed.
The report bore a striking resemblance to a U.S. drone strike in the Afghan capital Kabul in late August this year that claimed the lives of 10 members of the same family, including 7 children. The U.S. military initially said it had targeted a Daesh terrorist planning a suicide attack in the wake of the bombing at the Kabul airport that had killed 13 U.S. troops and dozens of Afghan civilians 3 days before. The Pentagon similarly defended the botched strike as a, quote, righteous one.
Daniel Hale, the former U.S. Air Force intelligence analyst who worked with the NSA, who worked with JSOC, is now going to be spending the next 45 months in prison for having let the world know that 90% of the victims of U.S. airstrikes are innocent bystanders, basically civilians.
To put things into perspective, the United States conducted about 1,000 airstrikes in Syria and Iraq in 2019 alone, using over 4,700 bombs and missiles. The official civilian toll for the entire year is 22.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight. William Jones, Executive Intelligence Review out of Leesburg, Virginia. And Danny Shaw, author and international affairs analyst out of New York.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us on the spotlight. Let's start this off with William. I mean, why has it taken almost 3 years for this news to be exposed? I mean, there had been people in the area who were eyewitnesses, as well as the central command in Qatar, that watched the whole event via drone footage. So why did it take so long?
Well, this was obviously a major cover-up. We don't know how often this happens. I mean, the fact that there was a whistleblower here and this has been revealed probably indicates that there are maybe dozens more of such incidents that are never reported. It was a tremendous operation, so many people who were killed in this, a tremendous mistake on many, many levels. And then it was increased by a conscious attempt to bury it. And this is which is the bigger crime. The death of the individuals, of course, is the most horrendous. But the fact that this can occur without oversight, condemns the entire war operations that the United States is conducting in this region. And it also points out the fact that the United States' war in Syria is a serious breach, a serious crime of itself, because if they had been working with the Syrian government, which they're fighting against, they could have revealed already that what the problem was, what was the situation on the ground, and this would have never occurred. But the fact that the United States has placed itself in opposition to the legitimate government of Syria is the really the basic problem that we're dealing with here, leading to this tragedy.
Danny, why do you think the New York Times has actually revealed this news? I mean, as William said, there are so many incidents that probably take place and go about with little or no reporting, especially in the corporate media. Your assessment of that?
Well, as if we needed more proof that to the U.S. military-industrial complex, Syrian lives do not matter, Kurdish lives do not matter, Palestinian, Iranian, Iraqi, Afghan lives do not matter. Why is it taking 3 years for this to come to light? How many other similar incidents with all of the drones and bombs the U.S. is piloting from Somalia to Yemen to the invisible bombs that they drop every day on the Venezuelan people, on the Cuban people, now rejuvenated sanctions against the Nicaraguan people. The U.S. has no right to be in Syria in the first place. So hopefully this sparks these important conversations about Syrian self-determination. No one has endured more suffering than the Syrian people in their struggle against Daesh. And as has become very clear, Daesh has powerful, powerful international backers. This has never been a civil war in Syria. It's been an internationalized conflict with the Saudis and the Turks, and of course, the largest imperialist overlord, the U.S., backing any anti-Assad, any anti-Syrian Arab army forces that they can.
Well, William, the U.S. military authorities say that 16 of those killed out of 80 were fighters. And even if they are correct, how can they justify killing so many women and children? And if they didn't know when they dropped the first bomb that there were civilians there, why did they drop a second and a third?
Well, this is a very good question. I mean, the New York Times has a lot of details on this, the fact that the people who were calling in these bombs were a very, very secret operation, and many of the monitors that existed, including one of the cameras, one of the high-resolution cameras that were looking at it, was not available to them, but they had the authority to call in this tremendous operation, allegedly only to be done if they were under fire, which of course was not the case here. So there was a tremendous breach of even the rules of war as is understood by the American military, and it may very well amount to war crimes. That a court, I think, will have to decide on that. But it's just really gotten out of control. The whole war situation has gotten out of control. And if the U.S. continues in this direction, you're going to have many more things like this. But I think that now that whatever the reasons were for the New York Times to reveal this thing, it was surprising for me that they did it and not somebody else, I think will lead to a major investigation, not only of this specific incident and not only of the rules of war as we know it today, but also will call into question the very commitment that the U.S. has made to fight against the legitimate regime of Assad in Syria. And perhaps there will be a reaction against this whole kettle of fish that has been built up by the military outreach and extended operations of the United States worldwide.
Well, William, just staying with you, because you just talked about not sure why the New York Times revealed it as they had, because that was my previous question, why did they do it? But now that they have, do you think perhaps that we are entering a type of transition, perhaps some type of reckoning, that actually the mainstream media is willing to critically look at what has taken place and what is continuing to take place in Syria?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that. knowing the mainstream media. In this instance, I probably suspect that the people who were involved in exposing this, who actually presented the information also to a congressional committee, and we're not getting a whole lot of response from them, also felt that by going public, they would get that response. Things would start to move. And of course, they went to the New York Times, and I don't think the New York Times is going to let a story like this go when they can make some hay out of it and make also profit out of that. But I don't think there's been a main change in the mainstream media. They go along to get along, and the change has got to come elsewhere. It's got to come from the American people, and it's got to come from the American people putting pressure on their congressmen to stop this war. We know the situation generally. President Biden got out of Afghanistan because there's a general mood not to be in the war fighting business here in the United States. And that mood has got to make itself felt among the legislators if we're ever going to avoid problems like we see in this incident.
Okay.
So I don't think there should be a change there, but I think there is a tremendous change in the public mood against this type of war fighting, policeman-like operations that the U.S. has been conducting over the whole world.
Well, Danny, there was an investigation, an incident, but it was internal. Now, if U.S. forces thought that their attacks were actually justified, why did they bulldoze the area then to try to hide the evidence?
Yeah, it's like the NYPD or any police department investigating themselves. We could never trust that investigation. It should be the Syrian authorities, the just authorities of the region who investigate. Certainly when the entire area was bulldozed, that is very telling. It does come as a type of shock that it was the New York Times, one of the main mouthpieces of the military-industrial complex. The New York Times, together with the Washington Post and CNN, the whole gamut of liberal, neoliberal media, has always beat the drums of war, bombs away on Yugoslavia, bombs away on Panama, bombs away on Libya, nothing but unfettered aggression against Syrian self-determination. But within these mainstream corporate media complex, you are going to have certain critical voices. Perhaps this was going to be leaked somewhere else. So, as William said, the Times got ahead of it so they could cash in on what is more Syrian suffering.
William, one of the Air Force's lawyers, Lieutenant Colonel Dean Corsack, believed that he had witnessed a war crime and tried to tell higher authorities, but nothing happened except that he was sidelined. And, I mean, we have seen whistleblowers, especially in dealing with the military-industrial complex, paying a major, major price. But the actual problem is really never addressed. Your take on this?
Well, it seems to me that there's an issue here of why this attack was called for in the first place. And according to the rules of war, it could be done only if the people calling it were in danger, and that doesn't seem to be the case now. But you've had them bending the rules a lot in this respect. And by bending the rules, they probably got to a point where they actually broke the rules. And we'll have to figure out if there was culpability on the part of the people involved in this thing, and that
jump in here. You say bending the rules, William, but even according to what you said earlier, which of course is true, I mean, the U.S. being there is actually illegal, right? Because the sovereign government never invited them in. So do you think that basically rules here are as the Americans create them as they go? Because if we start from the first point of it, it's illegal for them to even be there.
That's correct. That is the fundamental the fundamental crime here is the war in Syria, in which we are actually supporting groups that would ordinarily be called terrorists because they're in opposition to President Assad, and we are also opposed to the Assad regime. That is the primary problem, that it's a legitimate government that was elected by the people. They're conducting the operations of the country, and we're trying to conduct a revolution against them in the operations in Syria. That's the primary crime, but there are also two other issues here. Was there a crime, even according to the rules of war for the United States, conducted in this particular incident? And more specifically, there must have been a crime. There was probably even a greater crime in covering it up, because the cover-up itself can be an illegal matter which will lead to jail time. Obviously, somebody will get fired, but could even be jail time for people who perpetrated the cover-up. And I think that's what we're going to see moving forward. And I think this is going to be very much in the public view. And I think that will be very useful to teach the American public about what's actually going on.
But at the end of the day, William, sorry to jump in. At the end of the day, if anyone pays, what we have seen in the past is usually that it's some low-level military personnel that actually ends up paying the price. Never the higher ups, the general or whomever gave the actual order. I mean, we have seen that time and time again, that those who are mostly responsible for these crimes never pay a price.
That's absolutely right. And I think the problem is that the American citizenry have got to become much more enraged about this thing in order to force a change of policy and to hold those responsible who have been responsible for war crimes. And it's not simply the soldiers on the ground who are carrying out orders. It's the people who are giving the orders in a war that is unjustified, that is illegal, and that is itself a crime against humanity.
Danny, in general, why aren't these cases like this taken more seriously? Because if they're not investigated, excuse me, and the right people actually punished, then it's going to be repeated time and time again. Are lives in this region of the world less important for the American military?
That's 100% correct. I mean, what is legality to the U.S. unipolar hegemon? They could care less about international law. They trample over this paper law and mock it all day, every day, across the world, in every continent, in every ocean. How many hundreds and hundreds, 800 plus U.S. military bases stationed around the world to patrol and surveil and invade and occupy the sovereignty of any country on earth? As William has said, the underlying sin, the original crime, is the invasion, the occupation. Why is there one U.S. troop in Syrian territory? It's such an incredible double standard. They would never allow one Cuban soldier or one Syrian soldier within the U.S.'s territorial boundaries. And what we've continually seen, when there are brave whistleblowers, they go after these whistleblowers, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, with everything to send a clear message to the everyday Americans and GIs in the military, don't you dare raise your voice, or we'll put you in a box, we'll lock you up, we'll put you away forever, striking fear into how many young people who actually want to do the right thing. So when has the military brass, when have the West Point graduates, the generals, ever done a day in jail, been court-martialed, and the true war criminals, from Obama to Bush to Trump to whoever's in the Oval Office right now. It's bipartisan. These are war criminals on both sides of the aisle, and they need to be held responsible. But it'll never be the New York Times. It'll never be this system that holds the war criminals responsible. It has to be a mass movement in the streets. And hopefully this can be a teachable moment so that more young people join this anti-imperialist movement.
Well, William, again, if these crimes are not paid for, the situation would obviously just be repeated. I mean, we saw in Afghanistan just a few months ago when Americans bombed a house and killed 10 civilians, including 7 kids. At first, Washington reported it was an attack on Daesh, and then it was forced to admit that it had killed civilians. And so far, nothing has been done. No compensation, nothing, although the U.S. gave some verbal commitments. And of course, these people's lives cannot be returned either way. So shouldn't there be more severe punishment? And if it's not going to come from within, what needs to be done? What kind of system needs to be set up to hold them responsible?
Well, you know, the United States and President Biden is always harping on the so-called rule of law. When he's talking about Russia, he's talking about China. Obviously, there should be a rule of law which is beneficial for the population. And now that it's on the table, I think other countries as well will be talking about how must the world operate, how must countries work together in order to create better situations for their citizenry. I think that you'll see on the international scale an attempt to maybe not legislate, but at least to create a framework of legislation for how countries have to act, how they have to act if they have to go to war, and how they can stop going to war. But I think also in the country, as your other speaker said, there is a reaction from the American people, and it's a very divided country at the moment, and I think people will be out on the streets demanding change at the highest levels of this type of policy making, which they've just become tired of.
Well, Danny, just 1 minute we have left. Do you think the only guarantee for the safety of the people in this region is that the U.S. must leave Western Asia?
No question. U.S. out of the Middle East, the U.S. out of Asia, the U.S. out of the Caribbean, the U.S. out of every territory that they've invaded. How many coups post-World War II? How many coups, how many illegal invasions and occupations and drone bombings in the last century plus? But every dog has his day. None of these generals, none of these statesmen are invincible. The sun set on the British Empire and the Tsarist Empire. It will soon set on U.S. imperialism, the most powerful, arrogant empire in human history, so that at last the world's people can breathe in peace and get this imperial knife out of their neck.
And with that note, I appreciate both of you being with me. William Jones, Executive Intelligence Review out of Leesburg, Virginia, and Danny Shaw, author and international affairs analyst out of New York. And we appreciate you being with us on the spot on the Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
very heart of evergreen forests. Under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
An Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. God, oh, I'm late. I might miss the flight. The traffic was very heavy. My ticket. Where is my ticket? Oh, I found it. Here it is. Find the check-in gate for my flight. I'm going to take a trip to Desful, and after that, I'm going to visit the city of Shush. Today, I'm going to visit Shush Museum. Shush, or Susa, is a city located in Khuzestan province in southwestern Iran. Shush is one of the most ancient cities in the world. This city is 24 kilometers away from Desful. The ancient city of Shush is the capital of thousands-year-old Elamite civilization. This city has also been the winter capital of Achaemenid Empire. Shush Museum has some of the important treasures that have been discovered during the excavations of this city. Shush Museum is located near Acropole Hill, which is one of the most important archaeological sites of the world. Many of the objects that were discovered during the excavations of this hill are now kept in Shush Museum. This museum is located near Shush Castle, which is known as the French Castle, because it used to be inhabited by French archaeologists for a while. Shush Museum has six halls, four big halls, and two small halls. The four big halls of Shush Museum keep the relics of Elamite, Achaemenid, Parthian, and Sasanid eras. Oh, I finally reached the beautiful city of Shush. And now I'm waiting for a taxi, which is going to take me to Shush Museum. To be honest, I'm really excited because I don't know what unique things I'm going to see at Shush Museum. Now I am in the big garden of Shush Museum. The building of the museum is a beautiful brick-made structure and is located in the middle of the garden. The walls around the garden are short, yet the trees in here are tall. They're taller than the walls. Here, there are pomegranate trees, palm trees, eucalyptus trees, and jujube. Some of the statues or archaeological relics are kept in glass showcases. Their characteristics are written on a metal plate. Oh, look at here. Here is a big stone statue of an animal which has its tail stuck to its body. I don't know what kind of animal it is. It's amazing anyway. And a few meters away, there are the columns of Apadana Palace. Inside the museum, just in front of me, there is the statue of Hercules. It's Hercules standing calm, squeezing a lion's neck with his hands. What a wonderful statue! It belongs to the Parthian era. And here, there is the statue of a winged horse. This horse has been discovered from the Apadana Palace, yes. Oh well, this museum is full of unique things which have no pair anywhere in the world. Some of them include Elamite and Parthian head sculptures, stone inscriptions with Sumerian alphabets, sculptures of animals' heads, so many wares and decorative objects and armbands, etc. Well, describing these ancient objects needs time, and I suggest you to travel to the city of Shush and visit this great museum. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.